Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 4th of May, and Mondays at 9, all things political. We have two guests with us. One will be concentrating on the swine flu epidemic and giving us the update from Mexico. Second part of the hour, we'll look more at domestic political issues. Not that we won't the first hour, but we'll look at them more extensively the second half hour. Matt Grossman will join us, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Michigan State University. Welcoming your phone calls, as we always do. Our number is 800-486-8255. 800-486-8655. And the email address is talk@wpr.org. The Mexico Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times is joining us by phone today from Mexico City, Tracy Wilkinson. Hello, Tracy. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, good morning.
Hi. So how are things today? Are people back at work or not?
Well, not yet. Everything had been sort of shut down through tomorrow. You know, tomorrow would be a holiday anyway. It's the 5th of May.
Mm-hmm.
And so things are still shut down, although the mayor of Mexico City this morning said he wanted things to start to return to normal. I think some people will go to work today. Schools will still be closed. Most restaurants and bars will still be closed, I think, at least through tomorrow. But I think by the middle end of the week, we will see things start to return, if not to normal, at least not quite as shut down as they have been.
And how shut down have they been? Is everything just pretty much at a standstill, Tracy?
Well, it's a city, at least Mexico City is a city of 20 million people, so I would not call it a coast town at any point, you know, that many people. But it was eerily quiet over the weekend and toward the end of last week. Normally, parks on the weekend would be full of people, and people ventured out a little bit, but not nearly at the level that would be normal. Most restaurants were closed. Traffic was down considerably, and people who are out, many of them are wearing face masks. So it looks odd, even though it's not completely shut down. But for what the city normally is, it was quite remarkably quiet.
I imagine. Mexico's president has said that his country has contained the epidemic. What are you hearing about that? Do the people in Mexico feel as though it has been contained?
The people of Mexico don't know. It's the messages from the government have been very mixed. You know, when they finally acknowledged this was happening, they sounded quite alarmed, and all kinds of alarm bells went off. This drastic shutting of schools across the country, but then they saw the backlash of how the world started looking on Mexico as the start of this disease, and started canceling flights and travel to Mexico. And I think they then tried to tone down the calls for drastic action. And so the people are a little confused. They don't really know, you know, was this worse than the government said initially, or was it not as bad as the government said initially? So, the public is confused about what the real situation is. The CDC will tell you, you know, this wasn't contained, and in fact, containment was not really the goal initially. It was more mitigation. It was trying to, you know, keep the number of dead down and to treat people who got sick.
So is it your thought that containment, there could have been much better containment, that there was not reporting of the early cases of this flu?
Well, it's unclear. It took a while for the tests to come back that confirmed that this was a strain that had not been seen before. And so consequently, treatment was, a lot of people were not getting the kind of treatment. Cases I've investigated where the patient died, in most of them, the patient was misdiagnosed, did not seek treatment in time, and one case in Oaxaca, for example, where I spent a few days last week, the woman was literally turning blue when she finally went to the hospital because her breathing had become so jeopardized. So it's there wasn't a lot of information. I'm not saying it was the government's fault. They did not know what they were dealing with, but it did take a certain amount of time, a couple of weeks really, before people knew what they were dealing with, and that was precious time lost for a lot of patients.
Yeah. A lot of the news that we're getting is that people don't know what's going on with this. Then today we've got the chief of the World Health Organization saying a second wave of the virus could be the biggest of all outbreaks the world has faced in the 21st century. After we hear that Mexico may be containing this, we're hearing, watch out, it's going to get a lot worse.
Right, and aren't they saying it will come back in the fall?
Right.
Even if it's wiped out right now, or at least contained or mitigated now, that it will then rear its head again, possibly even mutated further, I understand, in the fall or the winter. So yeah, I think the main message now is don't let your guard down.
Right. Well, and it's hard for people to figure out what to do. You just wash your hands more, I guess, and wait and see what happens. We don't know what's going to happen, do we?
Well, exactly. And, for all the millions and millions of face masks that were handed out here by the government and the Army, many doctors say they really don't do much good in terms of protecting you. So, if this is the measure taken, then the top officials, the top doctors are saying, well, it doesn't really help. What do you do?
Right. Did Mexico have, the country as a whole, and Mexico City in particular, enough doses of the antiviral medication?
I don't think so, although the government insisted it did. Mostly medicine was going to the healthcare workers who were most in contact with potential cases. I've heard anecdotally many people complaining they couldn't find the medicine, the pharmacies had run out, the hospital didn't have it, et cetera. So I don't think there was enough.
Mm-hmm. And what about, I understand from the news this morning that Mexico is sending an airplane to China to pick up those people who have been quarantined in China?
Yes, that's true. The president, Felipe Calderon, became very angry that Mexicans were being what he called it discrimination, that people, there was this prejudice really against Mexicans now, that they're being painted with the brush of being infecting agents, and so the group that was quarantined there in China, yeah, they're going to go pick them up. The government is really resentful of this treatment.
What happens to the wages of people, all of the workers, all of the people who teach school, all the people who do everything in Mexico during this time? Are they getting paid for their work, or are they suffering some economic crisis?
Well, if they're government workers, like public education teachers, their salaries remain the same. The people who are really hurt are private business, the restaurant owners, the taxi drivers, the businesses like that that have had to either shut down or that are suffering from there not being circulation, or the lack of tourists, hotels and such. So the businesses, that's where they're really losing money.
And could there be long-term ramifications? I'm wondering how long it's going to be, if we have to wait till beyond the fall to see if this is going to just be a mild kind of flu during the flu season. Or do you think that because there has been this prejudice against Mexico, that people will keep from traveling to Mexico next year?
I suspect people will think twice about traveling to Mexico, unfortunately, and I judge from the kind of mail I get, readers and viewers asking if it's safe to come to Mexico. So I suspect that tourism is going to suffer for a long time.
Right. And are there precautions that you're taking, Tracy?
Personally, I'm not wearing the mask because, as I said, top public health officials say it doesn't really do a lot of good, but I'm careful about washing my hands all the time. They keep stressing wash those hands, and that's what I've been doing, I don't take the subway, so that I'm not in a closed, congested, small environment like that. But I do go to the hospitals to talk to people, and I spent time with the family of this woman in Oaxaca who died, I mentioned. So, if someone's coughing, sneezing around me, I sort of try to steer clear of that. But otherwise, I think you just have to, just normal precautions like that, be careful, and then if you start to feel sick, do something about it, get treatment.
Right. I'm wondering, is it just that we live in this global community now? But I'm trying to remember how the world reacted to other kinds of flu that were new. I think there was one in, 78 or 76. Certainly the 1918 pandemic was a different story. But these new strains, I can't remember. I was alive during that time, but I can't remember all of the concern about it. Is it just that we're reporting more, that everybody's ready for some kind of pandemic? Or what is it that has the world on this high alert?
Yeah, I think it's several things. I do think for years we've been sort of bracing ourselves, warned that some kind of terrible pandemic or large-scale disease was just around the corner. And so this happens, and I think all the alarm bells go off. I also, you mentioned globalization. I don't recall. I mean, what is so striking about this is that one day it's in a little town in Veracruz, Mexico, and then the next day we're hearing about it in New Zealand and in Israel and in Italy or not Italy, but I guess Spain. So it seemed to move so fast, and we were hearing about it in so many places all over the planet so quickly. That's to me what just was so striking, and I don't remember that from previous.
Are you pretty much centered on covering this story and nothing else at this point, or are there other things going on?
Well, it's, you know, poor Mexico. We were covering the drug war.
Right.
pretty nonstop, and now, yeah, that crisis, that tragedy has now been replaced by this one. The last week or so, it's been nonstop flu epidemic and how the country is reacting and how they've tried to find the beginning of where it started and trying to track down patients and families of the dead and such. So, yes, that's all we've been doing. I think I'm hoping by the end of this week we can start looking at the other things going on in this country.
Did the drug war stop during this time, too?
Nope.
No.
The drug war is the one thing you can count on will continue. There have been more killings, sadly, of police and some important arrests as well. So the drug war has not stopped. It was funny, one day they arrested an alleged drug lord, and they were parading him in front of the television cameras, as they always do, but he and his cohorts were all wearing face masks.
Oh, no.
Against the flu. That was kind of the coming together of those two stories.
Right. Yeah, there's a picture. We're going to welcome phone calls. Tracy is only with us for another 10 minutes and joining us by phone from Mexico City. She is Mexico Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times and has been covering the swine flu H1N1 virus for some time now in Mexico, including visits to hospitals, including responding to how the city and the whole country has been dealing with this prejudice against Mexico, which some people feel in government is very much at play right now. Even though the president of the country has said that Mexico has contained the epidemic, and the health minister of Mexico said that there was a peak of the epidemic between April 23rd and April 26th, and it was in its phase of decline. Couple that with news today from the chief of the World Health Organization, Margaret Chan, who said that a second wave of the virus would be the biggest of all outbreaks that the world has faced in the 21st century. So you've got worry about what's ahead and probably worry for Mexico about what's going to happen with their travel industry, et cetera, as a result of this. Feel free to give us a call for the next few minutes for Tracy. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now. And our email address, if you'd like to send a message that way, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Second half hour of this hour, Matt Grossman will join us, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Michigan State University. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tracy Wilkinson, we'll just take one call for her and then we'll switch our guests. Our call is from Mark from De Pere. Hello, Mark, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Is there some real deals for tourists, and is it worth the risk?
Well, I bet you could probably find some real deals, some cheap flights and some hotels, or maybe they're slashing their rates as well. I flew back from Oaxaca, and there were 14 people on my flight, which, it's usually a full flight. Risks. The State Department is saying to not to travel unless absolutely essential. I guess the thing to do, I suppose, is to wait and see how this plays out the next few weeks. I would not want to be in a position of telling someone to come or not to come. I feel relatively safe, but, you know, it's probably not a risk that, you know, if you don't have to take it, why take it, I suppose. I'd wait. I'd wait and just see how things play out.
Are you thinking of going, Mark?
Oh, yes. As soon as the school year's over.
Uh-huh.
But being trapped in an airplane with all the air that gets recycled is kind of concerns me.
Yeah. Yeah. That's and, of course, that would be true anywhere if you were to travel. So, I mean,
you'd have to
think about that, yeah.
Right. Thank you very much, Mark, for the call.
Welcome.
Yeah. Do you have time for one more call, Tracy?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Vicki is next from Manitowoc. Hi, Vicki.
Good morning. I heard a debate last night on the BBC. I was talking about the industrial food industry and these huge hog farms. And a spokesperson for the Humane Society said that for a number of years now, the Humane Society has been advocating reform of this industrial food system because it tends to spawn these mutant viruses. And I wondered if your guest thought that as a side effect of this current scare or epidemic or whatever, there might be a move to reforming the industrial food system, like this big hog farm in Mexico, where hundreds of thousands of animals are raised.
Right. That's a good question. There are huge financial interests behind it, as you can imagine, and the pig farm you refer to is Mexico's biggest. The residents have been complaining for years about the pollution that comes off of, you know, the soil, the water, et cetera, they claim is contaminated by the pig farm. The government insists they've tested the animals. They've found no sickness in the animals. So I don't know. I see really powerful interests there that might block any kind of serious reform.
Did this start at that farm?
The first detected case that they know of or have at least made public started near is in a little boy, a 5-year-old boy who lived near the farm, the pig farm. He did not work there. His family did not work there, it is the first case. He survived. He lived, but and there have been a few other suspected cases in that area. No deaths, I think, is the latest out of that state, Veracruz. No deaths from the disease there, but it does seem to be the area, at least as far as they know, where it started. Now, is it tied to the pig farm or not? The government says not, but you know, again, we don't have all the facts, I think. So.
Right, Tracy. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
I hope things become more like what Mexico City usually is.
Thanks.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. Thanks. Tracy Wilkinson, Mexico Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, joining us the first part of our program as we look at the news from Mexico City and a couple different kinds of announcements, one filled with fear here and great warning from the head of the World Health Organization, saying that a second wave of the virus could be the biggest of all outbreaks the world has faced in the 21st century. And then some optimism coming from the epicenter of the outbreak, with President Felipe Calderon from Mexico saying that his country has contained the epidemic. So there's the conflicting news. Or it's not necessarily conflicting. We just don't know where this is going. We are doing all things political, as we always do on Monday. We're just changing guests for you. And our guest now, Matt Grossman, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Michigan State University. We continue welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Lines are open. Email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Professor Matt Grossman, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, let's start with David Souter, who evidently doesn't like Washington very much and made this really interesting comment about going there for an intellectual lobotomy. He really feels that he gets his best mind stimulation, I guess, by reading history home in New Hampshire.
Right, going back to New Hampshire and he only went abroad once or something like that. So likes home.
Yeah, he's been there a long time to be so unhappy in that city, hasn't he?
That's true, but most stay for even longer, so with the lifetime appointment. So.
Mm-hmm. I think this will be an interesting choice on the part of Obama because he taught constitutional law, is obviously an expert in this area.
Right. The New York Times had a long profile by going back and interviewing some of his law school colleagues and law students. So anything you say in class apparently can come back to help shape what people think is going to be made of your choices a long time down the line.
There already have been some names circulating. Is it too early to look at? We're looking at women. We're looking at minority women. Is it too early, or has he made some indication that he likes these people?
Well, the Kagan name that's been floating is, you know, the current Solicitor General, so that's sort of the highest legal pick other than the Attorney General that he's made so far. So, you know, that's certainly a reasonable indication, though by no means a guarantee.
Right. Other things going on, certainly let's hear your reaction to Arlen Specter, who has now said that he's a Democrat, but I didn't say that I'd be a loyal Democrat.
Right. Well, you know, not a huge surprise if, you know, we usually see more party switching to the majority party. It's certainly more fun to be in the majority in the legislature. And Arlen Specter was, I think, about the third most liberal of the Republican senators. So if we were going to select someone as a likely candidate for a switch, he would have been right up there.
Mm-hmm. And it looks like he made a good decision in terms of having a chance of being reelected, maybe the only decision in terms of being reelected.
He was remarkably frank. We usually don't see people answer the questions, why did you do something, by saying, well, I commissioned a poll, and it said this was the best decision.
Oh, right.
He was pretty upfront about not feeling comfortable winning the Republican primary.
Yeah. What about the state of the Republican Party? That certainly is in the news a lot. We've got people who used to run for president who are filling the airwaves. We've got this discussion going on that this party just doesn't have many ideas, and it's hard for them to be a loyal opposition. And it's too bad because they should have more spunk. So we've got some difference of ideas. We've got, you know, a strong dialogue going on, which doesn't seem to be happening.
Right. Well, I think part of the background is that the country has more people who identify as conservatives than liberals, but more people who identify as Democrats than Republicans. So you have a Republican Party that is an increasingly smaller share of the electorate, but is very much dominated by conservative ideologues. And so you have people who want the party to move in that direction, and it isn't necessarily going to bring on the moderate voters.
Mm-hmm. I was interested in the interview with President Obama in yesterday's New York Times Magazine. He said a lot of interesting things, but one concern in the economy, one of the things we all agree to, he says, is that the touchstone for economic policy is, does it allow the average American to find good employment and see their incomes rise? What do you think about that? Are Americans finding it difficult to find good employment now, and will that be a touchstone to see their incomes rise, and when might that happen?
Well, I wouldn't want to predict the economic future of the U.S., but it's certainly the case that there's been an increase in income inequality over the last 20 or 30 years, a pretty substantial increase, and so even during the periods when we were not in recession, the income gains were going disproportionately to the high end of the income spectrum, especially in the last period of economic growth following the last recession after September 11th. So I think it's a way of saying that he is going to try to engineer a form of economic growth that isn't associated with a huge increase in income inequality, but obviously easier said than done.
Mm-hmm. We have more news coming, I think, on the bank stress tests. I got to tell you, I don't understand those very well. What kinds of tests are being administered? How do you determine if a bank is stressed?
Well, I think it's less than if a bank is stressed. It's you try to see if the economic climate is additionally stressful on the banks. Will they be able to maintain solvency? So it is a complicated set of tests. I mean, rooted in the fact that, you know, a bank is an institution that is taking in some money. and loaning out most of it. So at any given time, it does not have on its books, it does not have in its coffers but a small portion of the total amount that people have put into it in deposits. And so we're always worried about the total balance sheet of the bank, what are all its assets and what are all its liabilities. And this is a way of saying what happens if its assets continue to go down in value dramatically.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to a couple of phone calls. Mike from Appleton, our first caller this half hour. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. A comment and then a question. The comment is with regards to Spectre, I've never seen anything as despicable in my life. I mean, just absolutely, totally self-serving. And my question is, in the New York Times this weekend, there was an article with regards to Pakistan and some concerns about their nuclear arsenal. I'd like your guess.
Okay.
I guess the end of the question was cut off there. I think I got most of it. Well, on Spectre, I mean, I think certainly people know that politicians often make decisions in order to get reelected. I think what's interesting here is the remarkable frankness about it. I'm not sure that Arlen Spectre was that much more likely to make the switch based on chances of reelection than other politicians, but he was certainly more open about it. I don't know specifically that much about the Pakistani nuclear weapons, other than to say that the administration is expressing some confidence that the security of those weapons is not in doubt. Although, obviously, we have to take that with a grain of salt, since we don't have any other source of information other than the Pakistani government and the American government.
The president seems to be particularly worried about Pakistan, the inability of the current government to contain the growth of the Taliban. Is this going to be really problematic for him this first year and beyond?
Well, I think there's several of his top national security people have said that that's their top concern. Less about the security of the weapons of mass destruction, and more just about the takeover of more territory by Taliban affiliated forces within Pakistan. So, I think that's more their concern than a fall of the government. But certainly at the top, near the top of the list.
Our number is 800-486-8655. It's All Things Political. We go to Tim from La Crosse next. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I wanted to call and comment on the hate crimes legislation that is pending. I think it's going to the Senate this week. And one thing that was really surprised, I didn't hear this at all on Wisconsin Public Radio, is that Supreme Court Justice has already came out and said, Clarence Thomas said, that this law would be unconstitutional, which is extremely unprecedented for Supreme Court Justice to comment on pending legislation. But more importantly, the thing that's so disturbing to me is, like, if you look at our neighbors to the north, they had passed similar legislation, and radio broadcasts like Focus on the Family is not allowed to be broadcasted in Canada for the simple fact that they say it's hate speech, which is just utterly ridiculous. And my last comment is that what this legislation would do is, if you assault a child, there's a penalty. But now if you would assault a transgender person, which all kinds of acts like that are terrible, but the transgender person would have greater rights than a child. There'd be added penalties for that class of people, which I think is just absolutely wrong and, quite frankly, disgusting.
Professor Grossman.
Well, obviously there's going to be legal differences of opinion, and Clarence Thomas is not going to necessarily represent the court in its entirety as one of the more conservative justices on the court. But it is an open legal issue whether you should make determinations based on the motive of someone when committing a crime. We do make some distinctions in law already, especially in murder law, about the what was the motivation behind the crime, but this would be a new sort of distinction to say was the crime based on hate of a group.
Thanks very much for your call, Tim. We have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You're joining us there from Michigan. Tell me about the future of the American auto industry, Professor Grossman.
Well, if I'm unwilling to speculate about the future of the economy as a whole, the auto industry might be even tougher. Obviously, people are watching the news very closely, and everyone in Michigan has almost everyone in Michigan has some connection to the auto industry, either through family or through community connections. Obviously, when factories close, it affects entire communities, and people don't know which direction things are heading for their particular factories. Although I think most people are assuming that there are going to be a whole lot more job losses. I guess people took a little bit of solace in things not going down the liquidation route, but I don't know how much solace they should be taking.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about this merger between Chrysler and Fiat? Is it going to save Chrysler?
I guess you should usually bet on no with anything along these lines, but. He certainly the CEO of Fiat has had some success turning around that company, and so they're giving him a shot to try to turn around this other company. Obviously it was a company that was headed toward liquidation without tremendous government intervention and the willingness of Fiat to take on Chrysler as a partner.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Scott from Green Bay. Hi, Scott.
Good morning.
Yeah,
I was wondering if your guest could comment as to why he thinks that at least the consensus in the press is that the Republican Party needs to move to the center. And I think being, you know, just Republican light or more like Democrats isn't what's going to stimulate any excitement. If the United States truly is more conservative than liberal, I mean, you don't hear anybody ever saying Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid need to move to the center. I mean, it seems like it's always the discussion that the Republicans need to move to the center, but the Democrats are just fine. I think the problem with the Republican Party is they've not stood on their principles, and they've kind of lost their way as opposed to trying to, you know, please everybody. They should be standing on those principles of conservatism.
Professor Grossman.
Well, right. There's always this debate about, certainly there is plenty to point to say that the Bush administration was not very conservative, especially in expansion of federal spending. So there's always plenty to point to say perhaps if the Republicans had been a more conservative party, they would have generated more support. But generally, you know, if you have a if you have an electorate with a decreasing share of Republicans, then most people would say that you have to try to frame an agenda that appeals to lots of people who do not consider themselves Republicans. And even though there are certainly more conservatives than liberals, there's nowhere near a conservative majority because there's still a lot of people who say that they are ideologically moderate. So my point about conservatives being a larger share of the electorate was that within the Republican Party, they're an extremely large share. So if you're Republicans talking among Republicans, you're mostly talking to conservatives. So those people are going to, I'd say, fairly inevitably come to the conclusion that conservative ideological principles are the future of the party.
Scott's gone. I wanted to ask him a question. Okay, Nancy from West Bend. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Regarding the Chrysler situation, Wisconsin resident all of my life and seeing more jobs leaving, I'm a strong Obama supporter as well. However, it looks to me like an engine plant is being built in Mexico for Chrysler, replacing some of our jobs in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And furthermore, that will mean if they get government money that my tax dollars are going to Mexico for jobs instead of here. Can you talk about that a bit?
Well, Kathleen, you may know specifically more about the jobs leaving from the Wisconsin plant. My understanding was that they're transferring jobs to existing plants in Mexico rather than building a new one, but you may have more information.
No, that's about all the information I have. Nancy, do you have more information?
Well, it's been in the paper the last 2 weeks. They said that there are two engine plants. They were building one. My understanding is they were building one in Kenosha, ramping it up, and also ramping one up in Mexico, and that Chrysler had actually announced that they were going to continue those plans for Mexico, but not for Wisconsin or for the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we should do a show on it.
I think so, too. Absolutely.
Right. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. What about that whole issue of NAFTA and trade, et cetera? Is it surfacing again or not?
Well, certainly it's always a background issue, and it's certainly whenever the economy goes down, I would say trade goes up in importance, but it's up in importance from a fairly low level. There aren't that many voters who vote on trade alone. Probably hit a high point around the Ross Perot election and afterwards when NAFTA was actually debated. You certainly hear it debated in campaigns quite a bit, but there's certainly no indication that Obama is out there trying to renegotiate NAFTA with Canada and Mexico, as he said at one point that he was interested in.
Yeah. Thanks, Nancy. We will do a show on that. We should do a show on where trade stands right now, who's hurting, who's benefiting, et cetera. Well, we have some lines open for you. It's all things political for this Monday, and I know that we've covered a lot of issues, but there are so many issues going on right now. Since we last spoke, David Souter has turned in his resignation from the Supreme Court. The president now has a seat to fill. You can certainly respond to that and may want to say a few words about David Souter. We've got the swine flu continuing here in the United States and in other parts of the world. We haven't talked to our second guest here very much about this, but we're wondering what that will do to the economy and to relations with Mexico and whether or not this will contribute to an economy that isn't doing very well all around the world. What about the state of the Republican Party? That's being very much talked about these days. We can look at the auto companies. We can talk about healthcare. We have yet to talk about that. Oh, my, how could we not have done that? We'll do that. Here's our phone number. Lines are open at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that at talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. Our guest this part of the show is Professor Matt Grossman. He's assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Michigan State University. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program this Monday, Howard Gardner will be joining us. He is best known for his pioneering theory of multiple intelligences in human beings. He has written many, many books, and we're focusing on an article that he wrote in the current issue of Foreign Policy, Personalized Education. He says a quantum leap in learning will allow everyone to go to the head of the class. Throughout most of history, only the wealthy have been able to afford an education geared to the individual learner. But that will change, he says, for those who are responsible and those who are passionate about learning. He's a terrific guest, and he'll be with us hour number two of our show. This hour, it's all things political. Our guest, Professor Matt Grossman, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Michigan State University. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have yet to talk, I can't believe I haven't done this yet, about health care, which is starting to be debated. Do you imagine, first of all, do you think that reform in healthcare is crucial to a recovery in the economy? And number two, do you think that the president will be moving on this pretty rapidly?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure it's necessary for an immediate recovery. In other words, we could see an upturn in the economy before any health reform passes. Obviously, as a long-term structural issue, the increasing amount of GDP that's going to healthcare and the increasing cost for businesses and government and individuals is a huge issue for the viability of the economy. What was the second question?
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's going to be a big battle here?
I mean, I think that you have to generally the opposition has all sorts of advantages in the legislative process. That is, usually if a bill comes up, people who are on the no side have a set of structural advantages and also just debate advantages to raising risks about a policy once it's on the table. That is, usually once when a policy is announced is almost the height of its support. It's hard to generate new support over time. So you would expect it to encounter some problems as we learn about the details, but obviously this is a time period in which lots of people know that healthcare reform is likely to be coming and is important.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to John from Wheatland for our next call. Hi, John.
Yes, why, oh, why is nobody dealing with the top issue in the country and in the world, and that is our basic fundamental underlying root causes, the flaws of our economic system? Nobody's talking about why we must change it and why we must broach the diabolical capitalistic system.
What are you in favor of, John? What kind of system do you think we need?
That's where the problems are, right there.
Okay. Professor Grossman.
Well, obviously easier to indict than propose, as you allude to there. There are some new, there's a new book by Robert Reich called something called Hypercapitalism, which would extend the argument that the gentleman just made, and maybe propose some alternate solutions. But obviously, it's much easier to make incremental changes in a political and economic system than it is to make a wholesale revision.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Nadine from Appleton. Hi, Nadine.
Hi. This doesn't have anything to do with healthcare, but the other day, I believe it was yesterday, PBS, there was a woman from Mexico City talking about how they feel that the swine flu epidemic has been come up with as a diversion from all of the problems that really exist that they don't know what to do with, such as the 10,000 people that have been murdered because of the drug war and et cetera. And I was wondering, you know, some public broadcasting, you know, I have a tendency to believe it, and I was wondering what the take is on that.
Well, it's certainly true. We've seen the drug violence go out of the get out of the news cycle as the all of the reports from Mexico have been about the swine flu. I think you'll see a return to some talk about that, since all of those problems are still ongoing. But you know, I hope people will keep in mind that it may seem like there's a huge hullabaloo about something that doesn't end up being a huge problem, but it's sort of the circumstance that the media and public health officials are stuck in. They have to kind of sound the alarm, because even if there's a significant chance of a worldwide pandemic event, just like if they sound the alarm for a hurricane coming to Florida and it doesn't hurt quite as bad that time, we can't necessarily fault them, because that's pretty much what you have to do: assume the worst and prepare for it.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Nadine, very much for the call. Do you how would you grade the press coverage of this and the, well, we should put this in reverse order, and the government response to all of this? Do you feel that we're handling this swine flu pretty well, that we are closing schools appropriately? Are we getting mixed message? Do we feel pretty scared about this and we need somebody to reassure us? What about the overall way this is being handled?
Well, the only, I'd say, real problem was Joe Biden's comments on morning television, which sort of put everyone in a more panicked state about not riding on any airplanes or any confined spaces. But that was walked back, and I think overall the government response has been fairly good. And we also saw from the difference between Mexico and the United States that we knew a lot more information a lot faster from the U.S. government than we did about the Mexican cases, and that was part of the misinformation that we had about the spread of the flu, was that the Mexican public health system was not as good as the U.S. public health system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our guest from Mexico City was saying in the first part of the program that they were slow. They were slow to contain this in Mexico.
Right. So, you know, we should note the successes as well as the failures.
Right. It is amazing when you think about it. I've said this before, Professor Grossman, but there is so much going on so many fronts, isn't there?
That's certainly true. I do think that your emphasis on healthcare is a good place to be looking at the political system, because it's the next big thing that we'll be tackling, and it is quite complicated. There was an interesting interview with President Obama over the weekend in the New York Times Magazine, where he was pretty upfront about some of the basic problems, especially with spending on end of life care and doctor recommendations being taken by everyone being two of the main sources of health care cost expansion. So usually you don't see quite as frank of an interview there about health care.
Right. Yeah. And somebody has to do something, it seems to me, about the number of people when you couple this with a possible pandemic, flu pandemic in the fall or even now, people who don't have any health insurance in this country, and there are tens of millions of these people, what are they going to do about their health care? It just strikes me as something that has to be taken care of. And people of all political persuasions would, I think, agree that this is something that shouldn't be in this country.
I agree. I mean, I think there's basic principle agreement on trying to cover more people, or at least as many people as possible. I do think the cost expansion side has a legitimate point. Medicare and Medicaid both cost a lot more than we thought they were going to cost when they were formed, and even the prescription drug benefit that was just passed under the Bush administration cost a lot more than we thought it was going to cost. So I think that side has a point as well.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if the president will be able to. Well, first of all, let me ask you about Franken. Do you think that he will be seated come July? And what would it mean for the Senate for them to have 60 votes?
Well, eventually it does look like Franken is going to be seated. I'm not sure exactly on the timing. Obviously, there's even more of an incentive now to hold that up as long as possible for the Republican side. This 60 votes is obviously a significant number because of the ability to call a vote to end a filibuster with 60 votes. Just because a party has 60 votes does not necessarily mean that it's going to win all of those votes, but certainly it makes it more likely. And Arlen Specter was already on the edge as someone who might vote for cloture with the Democrats, but I would say he's probably more likely to. At least that's been the case with the past party switchers, is they've been more likely to vote with their party, their new party.
And should the Minnesota, I believe, Supreme Court decide that the race has been won by Franken, which would appear likely right now, do you think that it will end there and the governor of Minnesota will point him to the Senate?
I would never necessarily call an end as long as there are legal avenues open, and you have Republican national Republicans who have an incentive to keep this going. The governor has somewhat of an incentive to keep it going, although maybe some incentives on the other side. So, never know for sure how long it's going to last, but certainly looking increasingly likely that Franken is going to be eventually seated.
We were talking last week with a professor from University of Minnesota who said that they had done a poll in Minnesota showing that people say it's time for this seat to be filled. If I lived in that state, I'd be kind of upset that I didn't have my second senator, wouldn't you?
Right. Well, you know, it's a matter of what's the incentive of the person who lost. You saw with the House race in New York, it was actually settled rather quickly, I think in part because the opposition candidate could run again in less than 2 years. So had an incentive not to make the public angry for drawing out the process, but not quite as much of an incentive in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. The strategy would probably be changed if the Democrats had 60, or would it be changed? We're hearing a lot about, well, healthcare particularly, being decided by reconciliation rather than, which would require just, what, 51 votes rather than the different procedure they might use. So would it mean that if they thought they had 60 votes, they would go a different route with trying to get through major pieces of legislation?
Right. I think they are trying to keep that reconciliation option open as a threat to try to move members in favor of the overall bill. It's still going to be tough even to get half of the Senate to agree on a health care proposal, although, of course, now it looks more likely than it has in the past. Still, to get everyone together on such a massive bill is going to be a challenge.
Yeah. We have time for maybe one more phone call. Betty from Oak Creek. Hi, Betty.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I'm 73. When I was a kid growing up, it seems to me, and even into my adulthood and middle age, hospitals were non-profitable. And now, when did all of a sudden this changed over from non-profitable to profitable? And I often think of Milwaukee County Hospital out in Wauwatosa, and I always thought that was a county hospital. where the poor could go. Now, that's straighter, and I don't think they can go there either free, can they?
Well, I think people have tried to go. I mean, I know a lot of hospitals treat people, and that's one of the reasons that people go to emergency rooms if they don't have their health care. And I don't think they're, in many cases, turned away, but it adds to the cost of health care. Has the system changed dramatically in the past 50 years? Many more for-profit hospitals, Professor Grossman?
I don't know specifically about the hospital numbers. Certainly, costs have been increasing, and certainly there is some evidence that because we have a private health care system, actually there's a lot of additional inefficiencies in the system compared to, say, something like Medicare. But on the other hand, we should also keep in mind that we're inventing new medical procedures all the time. We're increasing the life expectancy fairly dramatically, so over time, there are more healthcare procedures, and there are more people who need those healthcare procedures. So costs are likely to increase, whether or not we have, they're administered.
Thank you, Professor Grossman, so much for joining us. Professor Matt Grossman, Department of Political Science, Michigan State University. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in Milwaukee. We have news coming up, and we'll return for this Monday.